Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. This is the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'll be your chair for today's program. Today's program will feature a conversation between William Crystal, noted conservative commentator and editor of the Weekly Standard, and Corey Shockey, research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Let me just say a little bit about each of them. William Crystal has been called the godfather of neoconservatism. And before starting the Weekly Standard in 1995, he led the Project for the Republican Future, where he helped shape the strategy that produced the 1994 Republican congressional victory. Prior to that, Mr. Crystal served as chief of staff to Vice President Dan Quayle during the first Bush administration and to Education Secretary William Bennett under President Reagan. Before coming to Washington in 1985, Mr. Crystal was on the faculty at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and the Department of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Mr. Crystal has notably been outspoken about the candidacy of Donald Trump. And he recently said that Donald Trump winning the Republican nomination probably makes Hillary Clinton president for the next 4 years. Today, Mr. Crystal will be in conversation with Corey Shockey, research fellow at the Hoover Institution. During the 2008 presidential election, she was the senior policy advisor to the McCain-Palin campaign in the areas of foreign and defense policy. From 2007 to 2008, she was the deputy director for policy planning in the State Department. And during President George W. Bush's first term, Ms. Shockey was the director for defense strategy and requirements on the National Security Council. Well, politics runs in her family and even crosses the aisle. Her sister, Christina Shockey, is Hillary Clinton's deputy communications director. So for a conversation about politics in 2016, and the future of the Republican Party and in this country, please welcome William Crystal and Corey Shockey.
Thank you. So Shakespeare in Henry V has his king at one point dismiss an objection by saying, "Nice customs curtsy to great kings, Kate. We are the makers of manners." And the way I think about the Weekly Standard and Bill Crystal is that they are the maker of conservative manners. They are the people who define the intellectual space of conservatism for the rest of us. And I just want to start our conversation by saying how powerfully I believe you have done so in this election cycle, Bill Crystal, with the standards wrestling with what a Trump candidacy means for conservatives, with what it means that so many conservatives are willing to support a candidate that that many of us have problems with, and that you most outspokenly, both in the Standard and in National Review's January 22nd edition, which was devoted, 22 conservative thinkers devoted to an anti-Trump platform. I want to start by asking you whether you think Trumpism would be possible without Trump. Namely, do we as a party have a problem with this particular candidate, or is this the new Republican Party that those of us who oppose Trump need to make our peace with?
Well, thanks, Corey, for the unusual introduction. It's the first time I've ever been compared to Henry V, I think, or to Shakespeare, maybe actually. Henry V, of course, is a great king. Shakespeare's kind of a prototype of a successful British king, actually, though when you read the play more closely, you realize that he's not quite that successful, and he leaves it all a mess for Henry VI. So maybe there's a metaphor there. But he gives a great speech. He gives a great speech at Agincourt, so that's important. And it was great to be back here at the Commonwealth Club, I should say. It's a different place, I believe, than I was last time. And I guess it's temporary, and you'll be moving soon again. So I look forward to visiting you in your new quarters. But this is actually nice and convenient. Lots to talk about with Trump and Trumpism. Let me say a word about America and Trump before conservatism and Trump. Just it's a broader topic, and then get to the Trumpism question. I mean, on the one hand, I think one can overinterpret these things. You know, you're in the middle of it's an unusual thing. I mean, it's a very unusual thing that Donald Trump is likely to be the nominee of one of the two major parties. And I don't mean this particularly in a polemical way or in a pejorative way. I mean, just as an empirical matter, as an analytical matter, neither of our political parties in America, this isn't true elsewhere in the world universally, but in America, we tend to nominate people who've had pretty high elective office, vice presidents, senators, governors, former senators, former governors, former vice presidents. That's been pretty uniformly the rule. We've nominated a few people who haven't had elective office. The last was the Republicans nominating Eisenhower in 1952, who had been a rather prominent public servant and public official, so he's sort of special. Before that, really, there are three cases, I think, where private citizens who hadn't held some kind of public office, either been mostly elected officials, a couple of cabinet secretaries, some general officers back in the 19th century, Grant and so forth. It's only a couple of times that the parties have nominated businessmen or lawyers, and that's happened really at old-fashioned conventions when they couldn't agree on someone and there was kind of we'll nominate Wendell Willkie or we'll nominate John Davis. So basically, in the modern era, in the modern political era, which dates from, let's say, 72, the modern primary system, we've just never had a phenomenon like Trump. And people like me thought he wouldn't win because we've seen a lot of people like Trump run. We've seen businessmen run, especially on the Republican side. There's usually a Steve Forbes or a Ben Carson or a Herman Cain or someone who's, an interesting person, different, an anti-politician, and they almost always, until now, haven't made it. So Trump is really it's a one-off phenomenon. And as with all one-off phenomena, almost by definition, it's hard to know what to make of it. It could just be a fluke. Maybe this won't happen again for 50 years. Everything went right for him. 16 opponents, Bush was the front runner, but he was too establishment, ran a terrible campaign, and people decided, we can't have Bush. Trump positioned himself intelligently as a contrast to Bush. Walker, who was probably the most, maybe broadly, sellable, one after Bush, his campaign blew up and he never even made it to the primaries. Rubio made some tactical mistakes and had a bad 90 seconds in a debate in New Hampshire. Cruz turns out to be a little less likable than even his friends who thought he wasn't that likable expected. There's always a temptation when something big happens, and I think this is true of political scientists like Corey and me or sociologists, historians, to want to read a huge amount into it. You know, and sometimes these things just happen. And whatever will happen, we'll talk about that this fall, and we'll be back to business. And I think it's a mistake to overinterpret it in some ways. It's not like there isn't a huge Republican Party out there in the country with 54 senators and 200 and whatever it is, 45 congressmen. And we know who they are. And I would say, in fact, from my point of view, they were the newer people in Washington in the last two or three classes have been better than the older people, more serious, more responsible. You know, look at the Republican class of 2014 with, you know, Harvard Law graduates, 9/11 veterans, a diverse group, Joni Ernst, Tom Cotton, Danny Sullivan, whom Corey worked with at the State Department, the senator from Alaska, young members of Congress as well, Cory Gardner from Colorado. I mean, it's actually an impressive group. The governors, you know, governing states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Illinois, I mean, are an impressive group as well. So you wouldn't have looked at the Republican Party in mid-2015 and say, this is a Donald Trump-like Republican Party. The insurgent, the Ron Paul and Rand Paul insurgency had been beaten back. There didn't seem to be much of a market for isolationism. Pat Buchanan had gone away. There didn't seem to be much of a market for that kind of nativism. You know, free trade is always difficult to sustain in a tough economic climate, but the Republicans had delivered votes for Obama's free trade treaties, right, which are is a tough vote for Republicans to put a lot of trust and confidence in the president. They saved him on TPP in the Senate and the House. Republicans have delivered votes for the surge in Afghanistan, again, not trusting President Obama, but believing in, you know, sticking to the wars we've been fighting and not slinking away from them and losing them. So I don't think we were crazy. I mean, if you had asked me this a year ago, I would have said I think the Republican Party and conservative movement are in pretty good shape on the issues that I care about and that I think we care about. And I don't think I was crazy to think that. So I think one can overinterpret Trump. And I think there's been somewhat of a tendency to do that. Having said that, he got a lot of votes. Didn't get a majority of the votes in the Republican primaries, but got 14 million votes or so. He won. It would be foolish to say it doesn't mean anything, you know. And I guess I would just close by saying, but let's just go back a step. I was having a conversation. I do these little film conversations. You can look at it if you want, Conversations with Bill Kristol, I think it's .org, and with different interesting thinkers and political figures and academics. And I've done a couple with Garry Kasparov, who I think spoke here with you. I had a couple of pretty recently. Who's a very interesting guy, actually, apart from being, you know, the greatest chess player ever and other such things. And he made the point that, but let's step back. I was sort of making this point of not overinterpreting Trump. And he said, well, yes, but on the one hand, he is now the Republican nominee. What will that mean if he is the Republican nominee for the next 4 or 5 months? That's not a trivial thing. I could be right that it's an accident that Trump emerged, but it could also be the case that accidents have very profound consequences in the real world, right? You know, things happen adventitiously, but then they've happened, and you've got to deal with them. And if he is the nominee, it'll be his convention. 50 million people will watch it. He'll be debating Hillary Clinton. 80 million people will watch it. I can say, hey, wait a second, there's a whole different Republican Party out there with these governors and senators and congresswomen and interesting people, and every, you know, half of America is going to say, well, that's very nice that you're saying this, but he's the nominee, and look at the things he's saying. And that's one reason I'm so alarmed about the prospect of Trump. So I don't mean to minimize the importance of it. Anyway, Gary's point, though, was, what does it mean that 45% of the votes cast so far in both the Republican and Democratic primaries, and 45% overall, since actually they've been about the same number cast in both primaries overall, have been cast for Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump? That is a little unnerving. And again, I don't mean to make a polemical point. I'm just analytically, if you had said 2 years ago, almost half the electorate is going to vote for, on the Republican side, a protectionist, sort of nativist, authoritarian demagogue, let's just call him.
Let's not leave out misogynist and racist.
Yeah, that too, yeah. I'm being nice, you know, but Corey's tougher than I am. Anyway, certainly someone who both in terms of his personal character, if you compare him to Romney, McCain, Dole, the traditional Republican nominees, and in terms of his views on the issues, is very different from the traditional nominees and in terms of his qualifications, obviously. So he'll get 45% of the vote on the Republican side. And on the Democratic side, a party that, again, whatever you think of these people, and I was opposed to them mostly, but still, the party of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, even, a party that had governed the country for 16 of 24 years, that was a liberal party, but clearly in the American mainstream, is now giving almost half its vote to someone who refused to identify with the Democratic Party when he was in Congress and in the Senate because it was too moderate. I mean, people say it's like, oh, you're calling him a socialist. He calls himself a socialist. He didn't want to be a Democrat until he ran for the nomination because he really believes in socialism. So that's a little, unnerving. It could be good. I mean, if you're a socialist or if you're a Trump person, you think, well, that's healthy. We're shaking up the hold of the centrist establishment on the country, and it's good to have some diversity and some disruption. And that's not a ridiculous point of view. But it is just, analytically, as a kind of social science matter, it's worth noting. 2016 is an election. It's not going to be one of those elections that's going to kind of fade into the history books, and people are going to say, yeah, there was another election. I mean, 2012 will probably be like that. A semi-popular president, kind of made it, got 51% of the vote against the traditional Republican who ended up not being a great general election candidate, though a perfectly good guy. You know, that was not an election people are going to spend a lot of time worrying about 20 years from now. 2016 is a very unusual election. I mean, one way to think about it, and I'll close, is if you came down from Mars 3 weeks ago when Sanders was still in the race before California and looked at the election, you would say, well, we have a socialist running who really hasn't changed his views on anything in 40 or 50 years. And I mean, that's really true. He hasn't. You know, we've had this unbelievable growth of economic growth, prosperity in India and China by countries that were on the verge of starvation and then adopted more or less free market policies and have been, you know, lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. We've had all the other developments, the fall of the Berlin Wall. And again, no one, you don't have to be a free market fundamentalist. You don't have to be a Republican. You could be a liberal social democrat type of you know, democratic capitalist. But still, the Sanders, to have a real socialist as one of your major candidates is pretty stunning. You've got this authoritarian demagogue, et cetera, who on the populist who's appealing to people's fears and frustrations on the other side. And then you have Hillary Clinton, who's kind of a, you know, insider. Her husband was president. They've done pretty well out of politics. You know, not the most impeccable record, you might say, in terms of her own personal conduct. But again, very much of an insider playing the game. If you came down from Mars and looked at these three candidates and they were described to you, you would say, well, this, yeah, we see elections like this all the time. But we see them in places like Argentina or East Europe. And I'm not being, again, I mean, I'm being a little facetious, but I'm not really being facetious. That is literally, I mean, isn't that what an Argentinian election or a Brazilian election or a third world election looks like? A socialist, a rich authoritarian demagogue, and a kind of inside baseball family member of someone who's already been president, who's enriched themselves somewhat by being very close to political power. And one of the great things about America is we haven't been like that. Again, whatever our problems, you know, we think we have a sort of different kind of system that doesn't fall into this kind of third world politics. And I'd say from a macro point of view, to get back to your original question of what the meaning of it is, for me, the most worrisome aspect of this year is it just feels more like we're living through a third world election than an American presidential election. And since I think on the whole, America has had a better record of preserving liberty and doing good for its citizens and for the world than most third world countries, I think a Trump Sanders Clinton America is not really what I would have hoped for this year.
Yeah. Nick Gallagher has a really great piece in The American Interest looking at our populist political moment, like the election that brought Andrew Jackson to power.
Right.
And it does feel a little bit like that to me, right? Somebody so far, not just outside the political mainstream, but a political arsonist of the mainstream, which is how I think about Trump and also, to some extent, how I think about Sanders. So the very best thing about the Commonwealth Club, though, is actually our members and participants. And I have a ton of questions already from people in the audience that are so good that I'm actually going to go straight to them. A shout out, first of all, though, to the person who compared Donald Trump as a candidate to the Manchurian candidate. Mm. I had not thought about that parallel, but it'll give me something else to worry about this crazy political cycle. The first question I want to read for you is, voters are clearly disgusted with the evolution of the political process and the continued dysfunction of Congress. What's the Republican Party's plan to reverse this disturbing trend? How do you attract quality candidates under these circumstances? This year, I will have to vote for the lesser of two undesirables.
No, that's a good question. So let me just say a word about the Andrew Jackson comparison, which Nick makes and other people have made. You know, I'd say one of the, it's a huge country. There are a lot of popular movements. The democracy, people are entitled to have populist sentiments, and they shouldn't defer to elites in Washington. And half the time, I'm sympathetic to the populists. I mean, I think a lot of good things in American history have come from grassroots populist movements that were impatient with the way business is done in Washington. Civil rights movement, environmentalism, movements on Reagan certainly was not, you know, the favorite of the Washington Republicans. So I'm not averse to things coming from the bottom up. I do think Trump seems to be a different. I mean, I'd say a healthy democratic politics assimilates populist sentiments, excuse me, tries to kind of get rid of the most, you know, the nastier sides of them, and then assimilates the healthy impulse that something's wrong and something should be fixed. And I think that's been, American politics has been pretty good at that. I'd say the Republican Party, incidentally, has been pretty good at that. So there was a big, in the early 90s, there was kind of Gingrich populism, and then the 2000s, there was Tea Party populism. But I'd say those things, in fact, were assimilated in the traditional American way into the party. Some people don't like the Tea Party side of the Republican Party, they like the establishment side, other people. But at the end of the day, they ran in primaries, they won, they lost. Some very good senators and congressmen were produced by the Tea Party movement, including Rubio, Cruz. I mean, it's sort of impressive how Sass, Cotton, it's amazing. It's impressive how many of them actually come out of that side of the party. Some slightly wacky candidates also came out of that side of the party. Some of them lost in primaries. A couple of them made it through primaries and lost general elections. That's sort of how we expect the system to work. But Trump is sort of a different thing where there's no taming of it. You know, there's no filtering, you might say, of the impulses. And in fact, I would say quite the opposite. He, in fact, took what were nasty impulses. He took a movement, let's say, that consists of a combination, like most of life, of sort of impressive and sensible and admirable impulses and somewhat less admirable resentments and grievances and hostilities. And he's magnified the resentments and the grievances and the hostilities and left aside the sort of more of the healthier part of the populism. So, excuse me, sounds worse than it is. So that I think is, you know, that's sort of why this is an unusual moment, and I don't know enough about Jackson to know where he would fit on that spectrum either. But we've rarely had a president, certainly not in modern times, of a Trump-like character. I mean, everyone's frustrated with Congress. The Republican Party was frustrated with Congress. They ran against Harry Reid's Senate, which was a very frustrating Senate in 2014, and won that election partly on the grounds of, hey, give us both houses of Congress and we'll do more. They've tried to do more, to be fair to them, but with a president they fundamentally disagree with, it's pretty hard. I do think some of the complaints about sort of the gridlock in Washington, they're legitimate on the one hand, but they're a little silly. I mean, the voters elected a very liberal, quite a liberal Democratic president in 2008 with huge Democratic majorities. They did get stuff done, for better or worse. They then elected in reaction a quite conservative Republican class in 2010, which was a majority, who thought they were sent there to stop Obama from doing more of these things. So it's a little hard to blame them for stopping Obama from doing more of these things. And, you know, I think on the key things they cooperated, on intelligence matters, on foreign policy, actually, for all the talk about how much bitter partisanship there is, on most foreign policy matters, there's been a fair amount of cooperation, actually, between the administration and the Republicans in Congress, or there have just been differences of opinion. And as I said, in some cases, the Republicans have supported the president more than his own party. Then in 2012, President Obama wins re-election, but the Republicans hold the House. 2014, Republicans pick up the Senate and hold the House. It is a recipe for gridlock if the voters are going to send you a liberal Democratic president and a conservative Republican Congress. I mean, it's, you know, we can say they should work together, and they've tried to, and they have at times. There have been budget deals, of course, and all that. The country has gone along in not such a terrible shape, honestly, in terms of the economy and all that, but obviously people would like it to function better. And I think that was the pitch that I would have expected a Scott Walker or a Marco Rubio or a Jeb Bush or a Rick Perry or a Bobby Jindal or just any of the kind of normal Republican candidates, even Ted Cruz for that matter, to have made. Let's have a Republican president, Republican Congress. We have the most impressive Speaker of the House in decades in terms of being a serious policy guy who has a policy agenda. We have a Republican leader in the Senate who's a little less of a policy guy, but who's a very able manager of the legislative process, and we have very good young senators who are really interested in the substance of policy, and we have chairmen of key committees like McCain and Corker, again, agree or disagree with them, who are substantive people running the major committees of Congress.
McCall.
What's that?
I was just adding Mike McCall.
Mike McCall in the House. It's not like so let us govern. You know, that was the Republican argument. Give us a chance. The Democratic argument was not unreasonably sort of the opposite, which was Hillary's argument was going to be basically be a slightly different version of President Obama, but better, and maybe I can have a Senate that will be Democratic, and anyway, if she were to win, she'd have such momentum, I think, out of that she would get some of her agenda through. And I think either way, you would have had kind of a restart in terms of how things worked in Washington. Trump has been such a sort of bizarre element to add to that it's just hard to know, you know, what to make of it, and whether we, in a way, now need to get through the election before even having an intelligent conversation, I think, about how Congress works. I mean, there's a whole other agenda, which I think is important, of congressional reform. The budget process is crazy. We have a good piece in this in the Weekly Standard this week by Kristen Muth, the former head of AEI, who's now at Hudson, very close to some people here at Hoover, too, who really an intelligent piece about how the whole congressional budget and appropriations process needs to be fixed. I mean, a lot of that stuff needs to be taken a serious look at. And maybe it will be in the next administration or by the next congressional leadership.
The next question quotes a passage from one of your articles to the effect that, quote, Trump has revealed the degradation of a public for whom many of us had higher hopes and expectations. And the question is, don't you think that calling degraded a public that does not follow its self-anointed leaders raises troubling questions about the leadership itself and the lack of connection with the issues of the day?
Remember that quote, but I'll take your word for it. Yes, I mean, look, obviously, elites, Republican elites, conservative elites were out of touch with the conservative base. Not all of it. Again, he got 45% of the vote, but a lot of it. Trump hit a chord that tapped into something real. Now, I think people are being, so, and I think that's a problem, A. B, I think a lot of us were aware of this and made this argument. A lot of us were critical of the excessively orthodox kind of pro-business economics of the Republican leadership in Congress and thought there needed to be much more attention paid to middle-class wage stagnation, income inequality, or income, at least, opportunity, social mobility issues. There's a large literature in the Weekly Standard, National Affairs, National Review, even the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which is probably a little more orthodox on this, saying, hey, here's an idea that would help with social mobility. Or, as Charles Murray and others have written, here are the real problems that are not so easy to deal with. Because, you know, if you can have 40% of kids born out of wedlock and grow up basically without a father in the house in many cases, their prospects of upward social mobility are going to be less, unfortunately, than kids with a happier home environment. And there's, you know, it's not that easy to say what government should do about that. So on the one hand, I think, but having said all that, I think it's a legitimate criticism of Republican elites, no question. On the other hand, some of the criticism is a little unfair. I mean, what are we supposed to do? I mean, are we supposed to say people are, there are losers from free trade? Yes. We've tried, actually, there are a lot of government programs to try to help those losers, if you can call them that, people who lose their jobs, you know, when their business goes out of business in Ohio or Pennsylvania or someplace, help them get retrained, pay for them to move elsewhere where there are jobs. You know, there's community colleges, and they're pretty serious efforts, as, you know, as much as you can do to help people. But if you think free trade net-net is good for the country and good for the world order, what are you supposed to do? Say, well, I'm out of touch, so I'm going to just become a protectionist and have a Smoot-Hawley trade war? I mean, that's not responsible. If you think it's important that America preserve the basic world order and be willing to expend money and sometimes lives, even in sort of tricky parts of the world where you don't get a lot of thanks for doing it, if you think it's important that Putin not be allowed to take over parts of countries without paying any price, if you think NATO is kind of a creaky alliance, but it's better than the alternative, if you think the U.S.-Japan alliance is not perfect, but again, it's better than the alternative, et cetera, what are you supposed to do? Say, well, people are very frustrated by these things, so we're just going to kick over the table and forget about traditional American alliances and responsibilities? It's not, I mean, there's a little bit of, it's a little too facile the way everyone's now decided that those stupid elites were out of touch, and why didn't they get in touch? Well, what does in touch mean? It's sort of like if you have a, you know, a kid who's misbehaving a lot at home, you can be in touch with him by tolerating the misbehavior, but you also aren't doing many favors if he ends up, you know, doing damage to himself, right? And so it's not as if people have this kind of, I mean, some elites, I will totally grant, are just complacent and inward-looking and don't care about these public sentiments. But I don't think that's really true of most of the sort of governors and senators one could think of. I just think these are hard issues. It's hard, you know, the world's a complicated place. It's not so easy to snap one's fingers and, hey, let's start winning wars again. I mean, you know, like really, I think the U.S. military likes to win wars. And I believe most U.S. political leaders would like to win wars decisively if it were so easy to do, but there are an awful lot of complexities out there. And it's not really doing the public a favor to simply flatter them or pander to what is an understandable frustration they have. Now, have people done a good job of explaining the situation? I'm sure not. And I do think Obama, fairly and unfairly, I mean, the reaction to President Obama on the right is one thing that's enabled Trump. It's just there's so much frustration with what he's done, the frustration I share in many cases, and how he's done it, and it's sort of, quote, getting away with it in terms of some of the things he's done that have stretched the limits of the law, I would say, that I think there's been a real mood created, and this happens in both parties periodically, obviously, of kind of, we need to just, you know, stop doing business as usual. You know, we need to be tougher, we need to be bolder, we need to, and look at some of the reaction against political correctness and all that. I think that was one of Trump's brilliant things, was to take on political correctness, not really a topic most presidential candidates talk much about because they don't directly affected that much. But there's huge frustration in the country about that. And I think we've been very critical of it at the Weekly Standard, and I'm frustrated too, and I disapprove of certain things the Obama Education Department has done, and I'm a big critic of a lot of institutions of higher education and the policies they've pursued. And Trump has somehow capitalized on a lot of that quite brilliantly. I mean, I think people shouldn't, I underestimated him, just how good he was at sort of this kind of, seeing what was on people's minds. But again, I mean, you can be against political correctness, and I really am, and I think if you read the Weekly Standard, you would have a pretty consistent critique of it, and you wouldn't find a politically correct magazine. But that doesn't mean that you go around, making fun of disabled people or insulting women or saying terrible things about, judging Americans, judging a judge in one case because of where his parents are born. That really isn't political correctness not to do that. That's just basic American principles, So, you end up betwixt and between. You don't want to defend political correctness on the one hand, but you certainly shouldn't defend going to the other extreme, in a sense, and embracing a kind of bigotry or nativism.
I have to say, for me, the biggest surprise of this political cycle was that last summer when Trump started getting momentum, started getting traction on the issues that you were talking about, there were so many other good Republican candidates that I kept thinking, somebody's going to find a way to turn the key in the lock and inhabit this political space in a way that is more generally acceptable. And I was shocked that didn't happen. Do you have a theory about why that didn't happen?
Yeah, I was too. And I think, some of it really was just the odd dynamics of such a multi-candidate campaign. And I mean, the Bush people were onto Connie Rubio, and the Cruz people were worried about Carson and others, and no one really criticized Trump in a funny way, and then some of them decided they should be nice to Trump because that would be a way of getting his voters when he finally fell apart. So there was an underestimation of Trump. There were some tactical mistakes, obviously, in retrospect, that were made. I do think we've developed a political class that is very cautious, very consultant-dependent, and too poll-driven, too focus group-driven. And polls and focus groups tell you what people think right now when you're doing the poll or focus group. They don't tell you what they could be persuaded to believe. They don't tell you where they could be led. I mean, if no one would have started Starbucks if you were doing polls and focus groups, there wasn't a huge demand for overpriced, somewhat bitter European coffee 25 years ago. Everyone thought, getting my coffee, if you'd asked them, they'd say, fine, I don't mind getting coffee wherever I've gotten coffee for the last 30 years. But, I mean, entrepreneurs see this, right? They create demand, so to speak. They change people's preferences. And good politicians see that. And I do think there's been just a decline of a kind of risk-taking. And Trump, to his credit, he didn't do polls, he didn't do focus groups, he didn't overthink. You'd read endless articles in the press, this is especially a Washington thing, but you saw it out here, of course. This campaign isn't going to focus in this state because this state's demographics aren't really that good for that, and they're running in this lane, and we're going to focus here. And it was all overthinking, and voters don't want to hear that. Voters want to see you make your case, and they'll vote for you or not. Trump didn't ignore all that. Trump ran in every state. He didn't say, I'm not running here because I'll do worse. He took his defeats. He lost. Let's not forget the first caucus. He lost Iowa. He lost Wisconsin at a time when it looked like it could be very important. And I give him a lot of credit. His attitude was, fine, I lost a state. I'm going to go now run in the next bunch of states, and I'm not going to change my message. I'm not going to do a focus group and suddenly put up different kinds of ads, And they could learn a lot from Trump in that respect, I think. I always cite Reagan since I met her in California. I'll take 1 minute on this. I mean, people have this, of course, mythical and sort of gauzy view of Reagan, now and after his presidency and after his, obviously, his death. But, Reagan was a tough, risk-taking politician. People should study his actual career from 64 to 80 when he gave a speech on behalf of a candidate who got slaughtered, Goldwater. That was the great speech that introduced Reagan to the American public in October of 64. Most consultants would not say, hey, why don't you launch your political career by giving your first nationally televised political speech on behalf of a guy who's going to get, lose by 24 points to the incumbent president. And everyone's going to say right after the election, this guy was a disaster for the party, but that's the guy you're identified with. Then you're in California, and you decide, I think I'll run for governor. Pretty high office to start with if you haven't been in office. And I'm going to challenge in the Republican primary the mayor of San Francisco, this shows how things were different 50 years ago, the Republican mayor of San Francisco, who was a man, I believe, named George Christopher. I mean, someone here must remember this, right? And who was like, people forget this totally. He was the front-running candidate. He was like the establishment candidate. He was a totally respectable guy. He was next in line. He was going to give Pat Brown a good race, you know. Reagan clobbers this front-running establishment candidate. Then he takes on Pat Brown, who had won by a million votes in 1962 against Nixon, who had come back, obviously, to run for governor after being vice president. Brown was a huge rising star. Not rising star, but a huge star of the party. I mean, obviously a major figure. Reagan beats Brown, has two terms as governor, ends in 74, promptly runs for president in 76 against the sitting Republican president, Gerald Ford, who's actually... Republicans are giving him a lot of credit for, you know, binding up the party and the nation after Nixon and all that. Decent guy. And Reagan just thinks, you know what, I think I could be a better president, and I got a different agenda, and I don't like detente, I don't like Kissinger, I'm more conservative on this issue and that. Runs in 76, loses the first nine primaries. Nine in a row. You know, everyone else would have gotten out. He says, no, I'm continuing to run. He hits upon the Panama Canal. It's a slightly bizarre issue, which catapults him to within 2 percentage points of nomination. It turns out he gets about 48% of the delegates, you know, and then runs again in 80 at age 69 and wins and is the oldest elected, you know, president at the time. So, I mean, it's just a good tiny, I mean, it's funny how few people know the biography. I always tell it to, you know, especially college students, kind of, I mean, that's a very interesting case study of a guy who, you know, had a real ambition, toughness, and risk-taking. Obama, whom everyone thinks is like so clever and political, Obama goes back to Chicago, which I would not say is the obvious thing to do if you're a Harvard law graduate. I mean, he doesn't go back, he goes to Chicago, which is not a place he's ever lived, right? Goes to Chicago to be a community organizer. We all ridiculed that in the 2008 campaign, you know, and maybe we were right, maybe we were wrong too, but it was a pretty unusual decision if you were politically ambitious, which obviously he was, of how you would make it. It wouldn't be the conventional view, I wouldn't say, if you were editor of the Harvard Law Review. Community organizer, becomes a state legislator, takes on this sitting Democratic Congressman Bobby Rush in the Chicago South Side District in 2000 in the primary, and loses 2-1, gets humiliated by Rush. You know, keeps on going, runs for the Senate in 2004, gets kind of lucky, the Republican blows up, ends up winning easily, and then just becomes a senator and decides 2 years later, hey, I'm running for president against Hillary Clinton, who's kind of a major figure, you know, has a lot of support. Gets a little lucky, honestly, I'd say, in the way the campaign works out, becomes president of the United States. I mean, people really need to, not that everyone should be like Obama or Reagan, or everyone could be, they're obviously very talented people, politicians, but it is a kind of, and it turns out that I very much like the current crop, you know, the Walkers and the Rubios and stuff, but they didn't quite have that spark that some of these other successful politicians had, I think.
So several questions about the near-term future of the Republican Party. I want to take two together since we're already halfway through our time. The first is, what are the chances that Trump won't be the Republican candidate? And the second is, today you tweeted that RNC Chairman Reince Priebus will be the 2016 GOP MVP and save the party from Trump at the convention. What do you think, who do you think the 2016 GOP candidate will be?
Yeah, that tweet was intended for Reince Priebus, needless to say. You got to give people a little incentive to do the right thing, you know, to make him feel like he can be a hero. That's all he hears all day, of course, is what a nightmare he's facing, and he can't really do this, but he has to work with Trump, and it would be good to remind him that he doesn't have to, you know, to work with Trump. I think that, I've been involved in the search for an independent candidate. That so far has not, you know, produced an actual candidate, but people who I think could have been credible candidates have chosen not to run. And I mean, the data is pretty astonishing. I mean, these are the two most unpopular major party candidates. The mood anyway, as I think one of the questions indicated, over the last decade or two has been sort of, can't we break up the two-party system a little bit anyway? And so I do think a credible independent candidate would have a real shot, outside shot. You know, there's a reason we have a very strong two-party system in this country. There's a reason people don't run as independent candidates every 4 years. It's daunting. But an outside shot to win, and the normal obstacles people talk about getting on the ballot and stuff are mostly manageable. So far that hasn't produced any serious major candidates. And I was chugging along on that. And then about 2 weeks ago, this notion of, well, wait a second, what about the convention itself? I mean, as Trump first clinched the nomination, became the presumptive nominee, and then started saying one thing after another about the judge, and then about our soldiers in Iraq who were absconding with all this money, allegedly, and living good lives, and then everything else. And people said, and these were delegates saying this, not me or, you know, people in Washington, pundits, hey, why do we have to vote for Trump? I mean, what is the situation? So it turns out people have given this some thought and done some research. The situation is kind of complicated, but basically conventions run their own business. Basically, there's a reason these things were always called presidential preference primaries, because probably, well, delegates are not bound by law to vote for who the voters happen to prefer. Now, the convention can have rules that can try to bind them. That's happened in the past. But it can also not have such rules, and that'll be a big issue a month from now when the Republicans convene. And so there's been this genuine grassroots kind of from the bottom, led by, I met this woman actually, I never met her before, a delegate from Colorado, a delegate from Wisconsin. They kind of got together and just said, well, maybe let's start a free the delegates kind of effort. It's gotten a much more traction than I would have expected. And I think here it's really due to Trump. I mean, if Trump had had a good month after he clinched the nomination, you and I wouldn't have still thought he should be president, but, you know, he could have convinced a lot of conservatives and Republicans that, you know, look, it's not great, but let's work with him. He'll tone down. He'll take guidance. He'll have a good list of Supreme Court appointments. He'll talk to Christie and Giuliani and Gingrich, people who have had senior offices and are serious people. You know, you could imagine, I would have been very easy, amazingly easy, to write a Trump schedule for a month that would have reassured, again, not some of us, but a lot of our colleagues who, to be fair to them, you know, were genuinely torn. They don't want a liberal Democratic president. They don't like the policies of Obama. They think that Trump could, you know, even if he's kind of a jackass and, you know, a buffoon and vulgar, so what? I mean, it turns out other presidents have been, at least in private, and maybe he could do some good things. And, you know, if you thought he had this person as Secretary of State and this person as Attorney General, you could sort of live with it. And it wouldn't have been hard. It wouldn't have been hard to go around meeting with senior military officers, go meet with Mike Mukasey and serious people who have been in the justice. You know, I could meet with Mike Hayden, meet with, you know, people who would convey, at least to Republicans, I mean, Democrats are never going to be okay with Trump, but convey to Republican voters and conservative voters that, you know, he's trying to be responsible. But he didn't do that. And that's, I think, led the delegates, A, and then B, the polls haven't, he closed when he clinched the nomination, but now the polls have opened up again. He looks weak against Hillary. So Republican delegates, out of both reasons of both conscience and, you know, their own political interests, these are activists often at the state and local level who care about what happens in congressional races and state legislative races, are looking at Trump and thinking, oh my God, you know, are we going to spend 4 months defending this guy? And plus he's going to take down, you know, if I'm from Ohio, he's going to take down Rob Portman in Ohio, and he may take down our control of the Ohio State Senate. And I don't know, every young person I run into says, are you kidding? This guy's the nominee of your party? And I mean, is that what your party stands for? And how do you fix that damage after 4 or 5 months? That, I think, is a key point. 4 months is a long, 5 months is a long time to have him as the face of the party. So I think people are kind of like, whoa. And then when they found out, gee, there might be a kind of way to avoid it, suddenly it really got momentum. So this is pretty recent. I mean, there's a good article in the Post, I think it's yesterday or today, on this you can look at. And we'll see what happens. I mean, I would say the odds, these revolts typically don't work. The Kennedy people in 1980 tried to free the delegates up from Carter. The Reagan people tried it in 76 with Ford. They got beaten back. This is a little different because it's not really on behalf of any one candidate. It's kind of anybody, but let us have a convention. Let us figure out who we want to nominate, but let it not, do we have to just rubber stamp Trump? I don't know what the odds of it succeeding are. I would say, I would have said a week ago, honestly, I would have said 5%, 1 in 20. Today, I would say, I don't know, 10 to 15% maybe, you know, 1 in 7, 1 in 8. I mean, I just feel it's like it's picking up momentum. I think Paul Ryan, who has bent over backwards too far, in my opinion, to be nice to Trump and to try to work with Trump, and I think out of good motives. I mean, he feels like he owes it to his conference and all this. Most of his members want him to try to make the party unified. I don't think that's very doable, but anyway, he tried. What he said on, was it Friday or Saturday, that, look, of course delegates should just could vote their conscience. I'm not going to tell people what to do. That was a big deal. I mean, the Speaker of the House, he's the most senior Republican in the country, saying that from his point of view, it wouldn't be shocking if you didn't vote for Trump, even though you might have been elected in a district or in a state that went for Trump. Now, you know, the delegate rules are so different state by state. Some people, in some states, Trump has slates who presumably are loyal to him as his party, his team selected them. In Virginia, where I live, for example, though, the delegate selection process is separate from the presidential preference process. So the assumption has been that the Virginia delegation would vote according proportionally, actually, to the presidential results. But the actual delegate selection is a bunch of precinct meetings and then county conventions and then a state convention and, you know, typically a local activist or a state, you know, someone on the committee or a state representative will get elected. And the assumption has been, and it's happened every time in modern times, that that person would then vote for whoever his congressional district or state voted for. But it's not legally required. It would be a big deal to overthrow it. I mean, it would feel a little anti-democratic. The Trump people would go crazy. You'd need a pretty good excuse. But Trump is giving you, I'd say, a pretty good excuse so far. I'm not sure, you know, really, I'm not sure it's enough quite yet. But I think the thing to watch, I would say, as an observer of this, I mean, is do other figures step up and echo Ryan in the next few days? Do other people say, yeah, you know what, the delegates really need to take their role seriously, and they need to think of themselves more the way delegates thought of themselves in the 1920s or in the 1880s. You're there to select a nominee, and you should select someone you are proud to have as your nominee, not someone who happened to get a lot of votes on the primary day in your state. And final point, I mean, it is interesting that it's helpful in this that Trump did only get 45% of the vote total nationally, and that's counting the last few states like here where there was no competition. So while there was competition, he was running around 38-40%. Now, he got more than anyone else. He won. I'm not relitigating the campaign or anything like that. But Romney, you know, got 60% of the vote by the end of the thing. Trump has the lowest percentage of the vote of any major party nominee in either party in modern times. So from a sort of democratic, you know, legitimacy point of view, it would be a little startling for the convention to turn away from the person who everyone thought had won the presumptive nominee. But again, it's a little less startling if he's not the clear choice of a majority of Republican primary voters, and he isn't.
So two more questions on the Trump front. The first is, what are the chances that a Trump defeat will result in a loss of a Republican majority in the Senate? And then the second is, what is your argument to anti-Trump conservatives who support him because of the Supreme Court?
I'll give quick answers. On the first, I think this, you know, right now, if there's no removal of Trump as the Republican, if Trump is the Republican nominee and things don't change much and there's no serious independent candidate, I would expect Hillary Clinton to win pretty comfortably. But, you know, it's a crazy year, and I was certainly wrong about the Republican race. And maybe the general election could also be very unpredictable. Typically, general elections are less unpredictable than primaries. And, you know, I think the polling is real and the data looks bad for Trump. But I don't know, stuff could happen. Hillary could make things could develop on her front that aren't helpful to her. He could turn out to be hit a chord in some big debate where suddenly it's like, whoa, you know. So I don't rule out the possibility of his winning. And obviously, if he wins, then the Senate, then you don't have bad effects down ticket. If, as I think is more likely, he loses and loses by a pretty big margin, yeah, it's very damaging to the Republican hopes to hold the Senate. An awful lot of the Republican Senate seats are up in swing presidential states, which means there'll be a ton of advertising in those states. The elections will be nationalized. If you have a Senate race in a state like here, I'd say, which is not a presidential battleground state, then the Senate race kind of runs on its own. I mean, here it's going to be presumably nothing, no big surprises. But still, you know, and here you have the two Democrats, so I guess it's a bad example. But whereas if you have a presidential race being run, like in Virginia, vigorously, the Senate race gets kind of swept up in it, and it becomes a huge issue. Are you for Trump or not? Well, the Republican Senate candidates mostly have taken, maybe foolishly, the position of, well, I kind of reluctantly sort of am for Trump, you know. And I just think hanging that around Kelly Ayotte's neck in New Hampshire or Portman in Ohio or Toomey in Pennsylvania or McCain in Arizona, I mean, it's going to be tough for those Republican candidates. Now, some of them have enough of their own image that you'd think they could separate from the presidential, and they might. And Trump might also be bizarre enough as a candidate that people might just decide, look, I don't like Trump, but that doesn't mean I can't vote for Rob Portman. So I think it's unpredictable, but I'm somewhat pessimistic about Republican chances of controlling the Senate. And I think it's quite possible they could lose the House if they really have a bad presidential election, because in presidential years, there tends to be a wave that can take the House along with it. What was the second question?
The second question was... what you how you would argue to anti-Trump.
Supreme Court has become sort of, honestly, I mean, I'm amused by this because I actually care a lot about the courts. I wrote about it. I taught about it when I was an academic. Weekly Standard spends a lot of time writing about that. So it's now being, the Supreme Court card is being used against me by people who, so far as I know, never thought much about the Supreme Court one way or the other, but who sort of are looking for some, and I don't mean this in too, you know, snide away, but are looking for some kind of reason to legitimize, you know, hanging on to Trump and the hopes for Trump. So I would say, so the argument is, and it may be true, that as president, since he doesn't know anything about this and doesn't really care about it much, he would appoint, let's say, conventional Republican appointees who are going to be a lot more conservative than conventional Hillary Clinton appointees. And that's a fair argument. It's not a crazy argument. And again, I would support a lot of mediocre Republican presidential candidates, honestly, based on that argument. But the question is, A, and this is where I think I am, and I think Corey too, is Trump just a mediocre candidate whom you're not enthusiastic about, but you support him because you kind of agree with him more than the other person? Or is he really unacceptable as president because of his temperament and judgment? So if you think he's unacceptable, you can't really be convinced by the Supreme Court argument. And this, the president does make a big difference on the courts. He also makes a pretty big difference by being commander-in-chief. And that can't be really resolved by good court appointments. I would also say on that that Trump's disregard for constitutional norms, or he seems to have no sense at all even of that there's a rule of law, limited government. No, I'm serious, limited. You know, the way he just talks about, you know, I'm going to do this as president, you know, as if there's no Congress, no rule of law, no constitutional, no limited government for a Republican, especially in this era where there was, I think, a healthy revival on the right of a sense of the Constitution's important, limited government's important, a lot of the problems we have are from what Hayek called the fatal conceit of thinking you can do everything, kind of state planning and unlimited government. You know, after that revival, to have Trump just be oblivious to any of that is shocking. But he could do a lot of damage to the Constitution as a president, even if he appointed people I like the best to the Supreme Court. And the court's not going to be able to fix that very easily. You know, the court is an important institution in America. But if a president is going around breaking the law and sort of having just disregard for the limits of government power, it's not that much often the Supreme Court is going to do about it. And finally, the Supreme Court is important, but it's not the only important thing. They've done a lot in the last few decades I don't agree with necessarily, but a lot of that's done. I mean, it's worth asking people who make that argument to you, well, what exactly do you worry about the Supreme Court doing? And honestly, there are a few things, some gun rights issues, but they're not going to, you know, take away. I mean, even if they reversed Heller, which is like a huge, you know, conservative victory in the Supreme Court, it's not like people didn't own guns before 2008 and have quite a lot of ability to buy them and have them, and depending on state laws, obviously. And even if they, on religious liberty, I think there's some very serious issues. But again, to be honest, a lot of that stuff's kind of on the margin. You know, would have, you know, so I mean, these not they're not unimportant. I don't want to minimize them. And anyway, do you really trust Trump to make these good appointments? So the Supreme Court strikes me as a pretty thin reed to rest on if you want to be for Trump. I would say the people I know who I respect the most who are still kind of for Trump, lesser of two evils, have a pretty, you know, their argument really is, look, I mean, at the end of the day, we have a system that's pretty good at constraining presidents. Richard Nixon was pretty wacky in his last year in office when you read those tapes. Lyndon Johnson was a pretty disturbed guy, you could argue, did a lot of things out of weird personal motives. But, you know, you have a Congress, you have a bureaucracy, you have cabinet officers, you have courts, and there's not, he probably can't do that much damage. And a Republican administration will be full of people whom we mostly agree with pursuing policies in the Justice Department and the Defense Department and elsewhere, and a Democratic administration wouldn't be, and that really counts for something. And you and I have worked in these administrations, and it does matter. You can have a pretty, you know, messed up administration, this gets a lot of things wrong, and still, if the whole body weight of it is going in one direction rather than another, it really makes a difference. You know, I was in the Education Department, which is kind of a minor agency, but, you know, it does matter. You would not have the Education Department interpreting Title IX in a totally insane way, which then leads to a bunch of lawsuits on campuses and crazy speech codes and stuff, if you had a Republican, you know, Donald Trump couldn't care less about higher education. He couldn't, except that he went to Wharton, which is an excellent school, you know. you know, and who knows who his Secretary of Education would be, but he probably wouldn't do what Obama's or probably Hillary Clinton's has done. So it's not a crazy thing to say, let's vote for the administration, not for the president. And I would normally accept that. That's why I voted for every Republican presidential candidate in my adult lifetime, not always thinking that they were the greatest, but thinking on the whole their policies would be better. than the Democrats. But that still assumes meeting the threshold test of is the person sort of competent and reliable, and especially in foreign policy, where there are obviously many fewer constraints. And that's where I think Trump, A, the temperament is just not reliable in the judgment, and B, on substance on foreign policy, he's terrible from a conservative point of view. I mean, the kind of adulation of Putin, the failure to you don't have to be where I am on, you know, an aggressive internationalist foreign policy. You can be much more restrained in terms of keeping America out of things. You can be more open to certain kinds of limits on trade deals and all that. But he has no regard, in my opinion, for the fundamental underpinnings of world order and peace, which are due to American leadership. There's a liberal version of that internationalism. There's a conservative version of that internationalism. That's usually what we debate every 4 years. But he's really out of that spectrum, and in a way that I think really would be dangerous. I don't know that it would be dangerous. The world is a resilient place, and we're a tough country, and we might survive 4 years of Trump being erratic and being nice to Putin, and there'd be bad things would happen, but would it be the end of the world? I mean, hopefully not, but it's a pretty big risk. It's a pretty big risk in the world the next president's going to inherit, which is a dangerous world. And with the challenges we face, taking someone who's so unequipped to deal with it in terms of foreign policy.
So for those of you listening on the radio, this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are hearing Dr. Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard. We have about 12 minutes left, and I want to move off of the Trump and this election cycle topic to first take a California question and then two more questions about the world to close out. So the first question is, how do you think Republicans of today look upon pre-Reagan-Nixon Republicans like Jacob Javits and Everett Dirksen?
Well, mixed. There are people who are nostalgic for the old liberal Republicans. I don't know that that's going to come back. But I think there are new versions of conservative Republicans, libertarian Republicans, moderate Republicans that will come back. I mean, things are never, history moves ahead, so it's kind of silly to think you're someone who 50, 60 years ago now, you know, that those policies are necessarily what one wants. But I think the party is, and I do think maybe here Trump will have a healthy effect, shaking up some of the standard kind of allegiances, talking points, rote answers to questions. I myself have found this. You know, let's make a case for certain policies. Let's be open to things. And I think some of the old moderate conservative splits might actually end up being redefined. I mean, is being less orthodox on economics and being more open to targeting the middle class and, you know, worrying about social mobility than Republicans typically have. Is that conservative or liberal? I don't know. Mike Lee, who's one of the most conservative members of the Senate, is probably the member of the Senate who spent the most time working on this. I think you could have a lot of rethinking. You should have a lot of rethinking on the Republican side after Trump. It was already happening to some degree. I think more of it needs to happen. I think that's pretty clear.
The next question is, what do you think the five biggest issues are for the United States?
I don't know. I don't have an automatic top five list. I should do that. I have the standard answer, I guess, which is, obviously we have Iran. Iran getting nuclear weapons would be a very bad thing, and I'm worried that the Obama deal has made that easier, not harder. Certainly made it easier for them to throw their weight around in the Middle East, which is itself gets to the second problem, which is radical Islam of various stripes. They don't always get along with each other, but they can always, they all pose threats to us and to our allies. I do think Putin, I would say I have underestimated, I think you've been better on this than I have. I mean, I've been very hostile to Putin and always wanted a much stronger policy to it, but I think I underestimated how central he was to the sort of destabilization of the world order. I kind of viewed him as this, thuggish Russian dictator presiding over a failing country that's, causing very unhappy things, obviously, for his neighbors. I don't mean to minimize that. But I didn't quite appreciate, and really took a couple of conversations with friends of ours and stuff to really think how much he's at the center of so much of the, or is making, enabling and making more possible a lot of the bad stuff that is happening, including in the Middle East with Syria, obviously, and including facilitating, things for dictators elsewhere in the world. So I think, a combination of Putin, ISIS, Iran, that is a dangerous world. Say nothing of China, which is presumably a longer-term challenge and threat, as well as an opportunity. I guess the way I think about it in a very shorthand way is, I think the, I think it's unlikely that any one of these people is going to be, you know, a competitor truly of the U.S. It's not going to be a Cold War type situation. But the things can go downhill fast, even if you're not losing to one person. And the alternative, the image we had during the Cold War when we sort of, you know, grew up in all this stuff was, you know, battle between two big nations and their allies. I think now the image is probably more like Rome or one of these classic situations where either there's basically order or there's chaos. The threat is chaos, in my view, more than, I don't think we're going to have 25 years from now, Islam is not, you know, radical Islam is not going to be persuading, I don't think, you know, hundreds of millions of new people to become believers in it. I don't think Putin is going to reestablish a Russia that's going to govern from, you know, huge swaths of land. I don't even think China, honestly, is going to end up being a dominant power in the world. I think what's more likely, however, is things can spiral out of control in different parts of the world. Other nations make their own decisions and decide the U.S. security guarantee isn't really solid and reliable. They decide they need to get nuclear weapons or maybe take some preemptive actions on their own. And suddenly you have a world that looks very different from a world that we've grown accustomed to since 45, which for all of its problems has been reasonably stable, reasonably peaceful, actually, by historical standards, and reasonably good for the people living in it, you know? I mean, an awful lot of economic growth and prosperity and human flourishing almost has gone out in that world thanks to the basic structure of peace and security. And I think people underestimate how quickly that could fall apart. And I think, and you've written on this, I mean, these things don't fall apart, what's the right image I'm looking for, incrementally. You know, it's like a bad neighborhood that starts to fall apart, and things, there's a couple of crimes, and there's a little graffiti, and there's this, and the street's not quite as safe as it was. And then it sort of can spiral out of control. I mean, you do hit tipping points in these circumstances. I think that's very much the case with world order. It's not going to happen. It could happen just, you know, one step at a time. Every 2 years, things get 5% worse. But the way the world tends to work, in my reading of history, is things get a little bit worse, a little bit worse. Then everyone looks up and says, eek, things are getting worse. But then we don't react, or others take actions, and suddenly you go off a cliff, you know. It's hard to know. In the Middle East, we are in that. We've gone off that cliff. If you had said 5 years ago, half a million people are going to die as a result of a Syrian civil war that everyone agrees we could have pretty much suppressed right at the beginning, might not have had a beautiful, wonderful outcome, but it wouldn't have been this, you know. And we're going to have a huge migrant crisis, which is destabilizing Europe. And we're now, it's also allowing Iran, giving them an excuse to destabilize Iraq. And it's giving ISIS an excuse to rally Sunnis against the Shia. I mean, the whole thing is much worse than people predicted, including those of us who were critics of Obama's inaction on that. And I think that's kind of what happens in these circumstances. And places that have been pretty stable, like East Asia, I'll tell one quick story. I was in Japan 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. I hadn't been there in 20 years. I know nothing about, honestly, East Asia security policy and very little about Japan. But I was with a group of people from think tanks and magazines. And it was interesting, about a week in Japan, and mostly on the conservative side. And so we were given, the prime minister agreed to meet with us, and very nice. And so we went to see Prime Minister Abe. I guess I was the senior person in this delegation because I was the oldest, I think. I'd been in government once, so I vaguely remembered how you supposed to, you know. So, of course, the Japanese are very formal. So it was like going to the Oval Office, and, you know, Abe sat there, and I sat here, and my delegation sat along the couches here, and his sat there, and the translator was right here. You know, it's like just like these photos you see of these, you know, they treated it as if it was meeting a foreign leader or something, kind of ridiculous. So the photographers were in, they took photos. I guess they were selling this locally in the press. Abe meets with major Americans, shows how important, you know, his success is to America. So we begin the conversation. And I knew a little, and I've been briefed by my colleagues who knew more about Asia, about what to ask him about, you know, and it was really a courtesy meeting anyway. And I said, well, Mr. Prime Minister, thank you so much for having us here. This is November of 2013. Thank you so much for having us here. We're all strong believers in the U.S.-Japan relationship, and we want to come and thank you for and Abe's been a very pro-American prime minister, so, you know, thank you so much for your efforts, and, you know, I'm just saying the usual stuff to, you know, that you're supposed to say when a foreign leader's hosting you. And he interrupts. And it's not been translated yet, but he knows English, it turns out, pretty well, I think. So he interrupts. His spoken English is not great, but you can sort of make it out. And he says, Mr. Crystal, can I interrupt for a second? So, yes, sir. Yeah. Go right ahead, you know. Right. And he says, what happened in Syria? And it was so out of context and also his English isn't that great, that it really took me about 10 seconds to kind of understand him. You know, it was just like, I thought, what is, you know, what is he talking
about? Something happened today in Syria?
Yeah, no, or so I thought, or maybe it's like, is that a play, you know, some way of, is he mispronouncing something local here in East Asia or something? But it turned out he wanted to ask about what my interpretation of President Obama's backing down on the red line was. And he said he had just come back from an ASEAN meeting, and then we had this long discussion. It's been reported since, so I'm not violating any confidences. And he said this publicly, really, about, he said he had a long discussion at the ASEAN meeting with, I think, what are there, 9 nations, I think, in this Asian, you know, group, about what the significance of President Obama's not enforcing the red line in Syria was for the U.S.-Japan relationship and for U.S. alliances throughout Asia. And I said, actually, I found myself in the slightly ridiculous position of sort of half defending, not really defending Obama, but of saying, look, I think it was a terrible mistake what President Obama did, how Syria policy is a disaster. But I think in this case, there is bipartisan support in the U.S. for a strong relationship with Japan. And I think I would do it slightly differently from President Obama, but I think both parties are committed to your stability in the East Asia and South China Sea and blah, blah, blah. I knew enough to make it through this, you know. But and I believed it, and I think it's true, incidentally. But it's really, it was such a wake-up call for me that, you know, what happens in the Middle East doesn't stay in the Middle East. It's not like they're not, like, aware of what's happening in the Middle East and Japan. It's not like they're not thinking to themselves, and this is true of the leaders of South Korea and others, geez, you know, if these people who are, like, close friends of the U.S. can sort of be chucked out of power, or if they say they're going to prevent the use of chemical weapons and then they don't, and then the guy gets away with using them, what exactly is the real commitment here? And maybe we should sort of, like, think about, why don't we have nuclear weapons? I mean, the Japanese, of course, are, like, you know, spend a fair amount of time thinking about this, and they're technologically, it would take them about 10 seconds to become a nuclear power. And it's not, they wouldn't be a disaster. I mean, I think if they became a nuclear power for the first year or two, things would probably be the way they are now, you know. But what are the implications of that, you know? And then China provokes them, and then Japan, and then South Korea, which doesn't like either China or Japan, decides, what about us, you know? The degree to which parts of the world that seem stable can become unstable quickly, I think, is something we underestimate. And we underestimate the importance of the U.S., basic U.S. guarantee of world security, the willingness to have troops in places like Japan and Korea. And truthfully, do we need to have 50,000 troops in Japan and 30,000 in South Korea? Is there, they haven't done much, they haven't fought, thank God, much in, you know, quite a long time. They probably won't. The world, again, you probably could pull them out. But why risk it? It's kind of crazy. It's the cheapest. We don't even pay. I mean, they mostly reimburse us for them. But why are we? And so when Trump just cavalierly starts talking about that, I mean, that really is irresponsible. And you're not just, it's not just the foreign policy establishment and a bunch of, you know, people in the State Department who are sort of clucking and they can't think in a fresh way. They're sort of looking at the world and thinking, you know, it's kind of dangerous out there. And this is kind of a part of the world that seems like we have fairly much under control for now, and the Chinese are a little bit deterred, and other troublemakers kind of don't mess around in that part of the world. And maybe we shouldn't just cavalierly toss these things out. So I really think this is where I'm so worried about Trump. And, you know, Hillary Clinton, whatever you think about her, she does understand. I mean, I think her policies have been bad under Obama, and I don't have great confidence that she'd do some of the things she would need to do to rebuild our defenses and so forth. But with Trump, the commander-in-chief argument, just to come back to Trump at the end, the commander-in-chief argument for me, and that's where he's not just a temperamental guy, but basically seems like he has sound, you know, prejudices at least in foreign policy and wouldn't mess with it that much, and he'd make someone reasonable, you know, he'd make, I don't know, Lindsey Graham Secretary of Defense and someone else, Condi Rice, she can be Secretary of Defense, and McCain can be Secretary of State or something, and they would have, you know, a reasonably traditional Republican foreign policy with a slightly flaky president presiding over it. You know, we could live with that. But Trump really does have some view about Putin and he's kind of friendly to dictators and contemptuous of what the U.S. has built up over 70 years. And that, I think that is very dangerous in the current moment.
So, my friends, the founder of this fine institution once said that it is our purpose to find the truth and set it loose in the world. And that's my favorite description of the Commonwealth Club because it captures the feel of this organization. Another thing that captures the feel of this organization is this enormous stack of questions we were not even able to get to. Thank you so much for your active participation in this club today and always. And on behalf of the Commonwealth Club, won't you join me in thanking Dr. Bill Kristol for coming to talk to us.
Thank you.
This meeting is adjourned.